for the opportunity to give this talk. So I will talk about two spin glass models in parallel today, the shared enteric Patrick model and what is called its diluted shared enteric Patrick model. And the model, the SK model, it comes from statistical physics. And I guess once you see how the Hamiltonian looks like, you will immediately understand what it represents. But I'm going to try to introduce it in a slightly different way or from slightly different point of view as just a combinatorial optimization problem. So one way to think about this model is to look at the following problem of splitting a group of people into two groups where you have n people labeled 1 through n, and then you assign everybody a label plus or minus 1. So everybody with plus label is in one group, minus label it's in the other group. So that's encoded by this vector sigma, the configuration vector sigma, you know, which sometimes I will, once I switch, you know, sometimes I will say vector of spins. So these are just spins also, another way to look at it. And the parameters of this model are the interactions between I and J. So this array Gij of interactions where, you know, here you can think of it as if people I and J like each other, this would be a positive interaction. If they dislike each other, it would be a negative interaction. And the absolute value is just how much they like or dislike each other. And then you look at what is sometimes called a comfort function, which is just the sum over all pairs. These interactions multiply by the product of the labels, the product of spins. Of course, you can also rewrite it in a different way. If I and J are in the same group, they will have the same label, so that will give you a plus sign. And so for I and J within groups, you just sum the interaction with plus sign. And for pairs in the opposite group, you sum it with a negative sign. And then what is sometimes called the Dean's problem is to maximize this over all possible configuration sigma. Okay? And because the objective is kind of clear here, right? We try to keep positive interactions as much as possible within groups, and we try to separate negative interactions into the opposite groups here. So the Dean's problem, it refers, you know, sometimes in this, like you imagine a dean splitting a dorm into two dorms, or maybe department, splitting department into two departments, something like this. So, and the question is what this maximum will look like. Of course, it depends on the choice of the interaction parameters. Sometimes it will be, you know, something difficult. Sometimes it will be easy problem. Like if it's a department of mathematics and statistics, it's easy to split, right? In that case, but what people want to understand is a typical, what is a typical situation? And the typical is simply modeled by taking these interaction parameters to be random variables. So you just think that these interactions are all random, and here they are chosen just to be independent for each pair and having the same distribution. And the canonical choice of the distribution is standard Gaussian. Now, I should mention there is a very simple universality result which says that once you understand how the maximum behaves for Gaussian, you understand it for any distribution as long as it's centered and the variance is fixed. So you can also take these interactions just to be random signs, plus and minus one, the answer will be the same in that case. So working with standard Gaussian is just easier, you know, for technical purposes. Yes?
So, you know, this can be one with a model of this so-called spin glass. Mm-hmm. But this looks like it's an infinite dimensional limit. Infinite dimensional limit. I mean, there's no dimensionality of space. And I just wonder, because usually in any finite dimension, mm-hmm. there's a sense of sometimes two spins are closer, they move
right.
strongly, and the further they don't hit.
Right, right.
So the question is that in your model, there's so every spin can interact with each other. Mm-hmm. So what are these? I wonder what is the locality play important role mm-hmm. in this type of problem, or does not matter?
Well, actually, okay, well, it's a very nice question. So maybe it's better if I answer it at the end, because then I can just say by comparison with what I talked about. But even the second model I will talk about is kind of an approximation of what you're saying. This diluted model, it's, you know, we'll see it's still. So here, of course, I should have. I could say this is just a Nising model, a mean field in a sense that there is no lattice. Everybody allowed to talk to everybody. Everybody interacts, and then we take interaction parameters, not like all positive or all negative, but just random. They could be both positive and negative. So they are disordered, right? That's why this is called a disorder. This GIJ. And that's where the name glass, I guess, is coming from, right? So, okay, so it's, in this model, okay, it's easy to see that this maximum will be of order n to the 3/2, but the amazing thing that came from, you know, work of physicists, and in particular Giorgio Parisi around 1980, is that you can get exact formula for the asymptotics. So if you take this maximum and you scale it by the correct order n to the 3/2, and you take a limit, you get some exact answer, and there is a formula for that. Now here I'm writing, also I include this expectation is the average, so what happens on average over the randomness of the disorder, but you can also remove that and you will get the same limit. So, you know, just, I think in physics you say self-averaging, right? The ground state is a self-averaging quantity, so even without expected value, you get this limit with probability one. So in particular, this typical fun example that you see in physics books, that if you take that limit and use it as approximation for the case of 10,000 and, you know, see what this means on average from the point of view of one person, this would result that under the optimal solution, in your half, you would still have, you know, this 2462 people you don't like who have negative interactions. So, of course, you can compare it with completely random solution where you just split everybody in half, and in your half, half of the people will be, you know, will have negative interactions. So you don't like. You see, the gain here is actually looks very surprisingly small, right? So that's the SK model. Now let me, you know, once I motivated this a little bit, the actual Hamiltonian that we work with usually is defined slightly differently. First of all, it's a convention to introduce the scaling 1 over square root of n from the beginning so that the Hamiltonian is of order n, so scales, you know, linearly with the size of the system. And it's also convenient to include all pairs I and j instead of, not all pairs, but all indices I and j. Because if you include, you know, self-interactions, they don't really contribute anything to the sum, and counting ij twice, well, it's just a matter of scaling. You have two Gaussian instead of one, you can rescale. So it's convenient to work with this one because the computation just becomes a little bit cleaner. And in particular, if you look at this quantity called the overlap of two configurations, which is just a scalar product of two spin configurations normalized by n to make it of order one quantity, you can easily compute the covariance of this Gaussian process. And the covariance, well, clearly, right? Maybe I should use the opportunity to use the stick. Okay, when you compute the covariance, you get this 1 over n, and because the interactions are independent, you pick up a pair ij from the first and second configuration. And when you look what this is, it's nothing but the square of the overlap times the factor n. So the Hamiltonian here is a function of just the scalar product, which is what makes this model really special compared to many other models. So you have invariance here under orthogonal transformations. And it doesn't really matter here that, you know, our random function is a function of this plus and minus one spins, because if you take, you know, the space of configurations and rotate it, the scalar products will not be affected, right? So the covariance will be the same. It will still be the same Hamiltonian in distribution. So everything in this model is encoded only by the overlaps between spin configurations. And individual coordinates really are not that important. Now, in diluted model, so let me show first what diluted version of this model looks like. Basically,
I don't understand the last remark you made.
Oh, the last.
Isn't the choice of plus minus one that breaks the rotational invariance on a microscopic scale?
Well, no, what I'm saying is, from the point of view of this process, it will be the same process if you take your, you know, this space of all spin configuration, and if you just rotate it by some orthogonal transformation, the process will not notice this random function. It will be the same random function in distribution.
But if you rotate them, it won't be a valid configuration.
Anymore. Oh, it won't be a valid configuration, but it will be the same. Statistically, you won't distinguish between the two processes.
Sure.
Right. Of course, you can still ask questions about individual spins if you want, but when we look for, let's say, maximum ground state energy, that won't change how the ground state energy behaves, right? But this will be broken in diluted model. It will no longer be true. So what is a diluted model? So the name diluted just means that instead of each person interacting with everybody else, you just allow to interact with finite subset of people. And the way this is achieved is, instead of complete graph of interaction, you choose a random Erdős-Rényi subgraph, where each interaction is chosen with small probability proportional to 1 over n. Okay, and so in this model, each person will end up interacting with finitely many people, and the Hamiltonian will be, well, the terms will be the same. You have some Gaussian interaction times the product of spin, but now there will be of order n of them. And you can choose this number, in this case, to be just a Poisson random variable proportional to n, where this parameter lambda is called the connectivity parameter. And each pair, interacting pair, is chosen completely randomly from all possibilities. So here you don't have this invariance, rotational invariance. So in this model, it becomes really essential that you are looking at a random function of this plus and minus one spins. And so in order to compute free energy, for example, you have to describe much more what's going on in this model, as I will explain later. Okay. Now, so the motivation is to study the maximum. And that's another way to look at the free energy. So for mathematicians, if you just think of this as a random optimization problem, you know, maximum is a very bad function of the process, you know, not smooth function of the process. So we think of free energy just as a smooth approximation of the maximum. So when you take a positive inverse temperature parameter and you define this free energy in the usual way, I'm assuming everybody knows here free energy, or are there some students who haven't seen free energy? No, impossible. Okay, so, right, what is the connection to the maximum? It's the well-known connection, right, that if you, in the sum of all these contributions to the partition function, if you just choose one term, the largest one, that then you get the lower bound, right? Exponent and log cancel, so you get maximum scaled by n on this side. And for the upper bound, if you replace each term by the largest one, you have 2 to the n of them, so you get additional factor log of 2 over beta, right, on this side. So the scaled maximum and free energy are within this term of each other, log of 2 over beta. So when you let temperature go to 0, you just recover the maximum or the ground state energy. And also, this allows you to interchange the limits, right? First, you can compute the limit of the free energy and then let the temperature go to 0 after that. So, in fact, in physics, that's the formula that Parisi discovered. The formula is for the free energy. So he discovered or invented in 1980, and it was proved rigorously by Talleyrand in 2003 after some important work of Francesco Guerra, where Guerra showed that this formula gives an upper bound on the free energy, and then, you know, Talleyrand pushed these ideas much further to show that the upper bound is exact limit. Now, in the diluted case, there is also a formula for the free energy, which originates in this work of Mizard and Parisi in 2001. And this one is still an open problem mathematically. Okay. Now, I did not write them down here because first of all, they're a little bit complicated, and I think when you look at them, you know, they won't tell you anything about what's going on just by looking at the models. I can show it maybe later at the end. I can just open my next talk and show you how the formula looks like. But for now, let me not say it. And there is another reason I didn't write them here is because that's another part of the story which I will not talk about, is that in at least in physics literature, the formula for the free energy is derived in a kind of very basic way as a consequence of much more general theory about the structure of the Gibbs measure. Okay, so my focus really will be on the most interesting things, the Gibbs measure and, you know, this question here, how we can describe the Gibbs measure in the thermodynamic limit, right, when you let m go to infinity. Actually, Talleyrand's work, Talleyrand's proof, it found a very complicated way around this predictions of Parisi about the Gibbs measure. But now that we know how to prove the Parisi ansatz, there is much more direct and natural way also to prove the formula for the free energy. And for diluted model, again, what we don't know how to prove yet in general is this prediction about the structure of the Gibbs measure. But once we have it, there is also a pretty natural way to, you know, obtain the formula for the free energy from it. Okay.
I think you're using a different convention. There's a minus sign.
Yes. I'm using as mathematicians. Well, okay. We have a symmetric Hamiltonian here in distribution. So minus sign, you get the same Hamiltonian in distribution, and that's why I also talk about maximum instead of the minimum. But yes, they two cancel each other. That's okay. Yes. There should be a minus sign, and I should talk about ground state energy around then maximum, but otherwise we are talking about the same thing. Okay, so I guess everybody also knows what the Gibbs measure is here, so I don't need to explain that part. I will explain it in Toronto tomorrow, okay, to mathematicians. Okay, so the first thing then to describe these predictions of the physicists, the first thing I'm going to do is to show.
No one says Gibbs measure.
Nobody. What?
They don't say measure.
What is
Gibbs factor?
Distribution.
Oh, Gibbs distribution.
Gibbs wave.
Or don't we call it the Boltzmann factor?
Okay. That's good. Good to know. That's why you go to talks to learn something new, right? All right, so the first thing I want to talk about is not really this description, you know, what is called Parisi ansatz or Mizard Parisi ansatz. First, I will explain that there is a template to talk about those things. And the template is that you can first pass to the thermodynamic limit and define some kind of analog of the Gibbs measure in the limit. And then you can talk about this already being in the limit precisely. So there is some kind of analog of the Gibbs measure in the limit. And so in physics, when they describe, you know, their ansatz, usually they just make some precise statements, which of course cannot be true for systems of finite size. So somehow they visualize being in the limit already anyway, but it turns out there is a formal way to pass to the limit. And there is also more important reason to do this, namely all the mathematical results were proved this way. Okay, when you pass to the limit, the properties which you have for the original system that hold only approximately, they become exact in the limit, and then they become much more powerful for this reason. So you can get much more out of them. So let me explain how you can pass to the limit and recover some kind of Gibbs measure in the limit. So what we'll do for that is simply look at the infinite sequence of replicas sampled from the Gibbs measure. So you just look at infinite sample of your spin configurations and write them down as this infinite matrix where one row is just one configuration sampled from the Gibbs measure. Now, since I want to pass to the limit, of course, for a system of finite size, each row will have only n coordinates. But I want to let n go to infinity, so, you know, temporarily you can think that each row is filled with plus one after that. So let's think of this just as an infinite matrix in both directions. So of course, if you just look at this random look at this as a random matrix of plus and minus one generated in this way, it's clear that you didn't lose any information. I guess the physicists would say, okay, you get observables here which include everything. You see everything. So you didn't lose any information. And of course, from this matrix, you can recover your Gibbs measure because you can simply look how frequently you observe each configuration in the sample, right? The frequency is exactly the Gibbs weight corresponding to that configuration. So that's one thing. But another important thing for us is that the free energy, so since we are motivated to compute the free energy, it turns out you can really think of this as a nice continuous function of the distribution of this array. If I tell you the distribution of this array and I tell you what the limit is, then at least in principle, you automatically know what the free energy is in the limit. So that's exactly what we'll do. We'll pass to the limit just by seeing what happens to this array in the limit. So in the end, you end up just with a random array of plus and minus one. And I should also say that except in some special modifications of the SK model, in general, we do not know how to show there is a unique limit, but it really doesn't matter. Let's look at all possible limits of the distribution of this array over subsequences. And then if we can show that any limit is described has the structure that the physicists predict, then that's enough to recover the formula for the free energy. Okay, so let's look at any such limit. Just imagine what you have, this random matrix with some kind of distribution in the limit, but the Gibbs measure disappeared for a second. Right now you just have configurations which are infinitely many spins in the limit, so it's not clear that it comes from any kind of random measure. But there is a random measure, and the main reason for this is these two symmetries that you have, right? You have, if you take this array of spins, you can reorder your columns and rows, and it will not affect the distribution of the array. Now, the upper index here, remember the upper index was corresponded to the rows. So reordering the rows, it's just reordering the replicates. Of course, that does not have changed the distribution of the array. So this is called a replica symmetry. But why do we also have a symmetry under the permutation of spins or coordinates? Well, that's simply because we are looking at a mean field model here, and all the spins play the same role, right? We didn't have any boundary condition on the lattice or anything like this. If you look at the Hamiltonian, you know, and you reorder the coordinates, you still get the same Hamiltonian in distribution. So that's what is called symmetry between sites, and that's what happens in mean field models. Okay. Now, if you have these two symmetries, these are called exchangeable arrays. It turns out there is a representation of how these arrays can be generated. So that's the so-called Aldous-Huber representation. And this is just a two-dimensional of analog of Definetti. Maybe many of you have heard about Definetti representation for just exchangeable sequences. You have one sequence. So if you have one sequence and it has this symmetry that you can permute them and you get the same distribution, what you will get is you can generate any array like that. Well, maybe if you just look at this function and you close the last two coordinates, this will be a representation for one-dimensional array. If you have a two-dimensional array, it's sort of given by a tensor product of that representation you have. So you can take a function of four coordinates with values in plus and minus one, because that's our spins. And what you do is you plug in as a coordinates IID uniform random variables on 0, 1. So the first coordinate does not have any index. So you can think of this is a randomness of the whole, kind of common randomness of the whole array. The second coordinate, the second sequence depends on the row index. So this is sort of some kind of replica randomness. The third one has only the index corresponding to the spins. So this is a row randomness. And the last one is just an independent randomness at each entry of this array. So you have this kind of representation when you have these two symmetries. And also you can see right away that the last coordinate is not really necessary to keep here, because the role of the last coordinate, since our spins just take two values, plus and minus one, and this xil is independent at every entry, it's like flipping a coin. So if I just give you the average, if I give you the average of this with respect to the last coordinate, which will now be a function of three variables, then all you need to do is flip a coin at that entry with that average, and that will give you the spin plus and minus one. So in other words, a function of three variables encodes any limit here. And then finally, how you can there is a way to think about this function as a Gibbs measure. There is a geometric interpretation of for this kind of process of generating this array. And the geometric interpretation is the following. So in the original model, our basic object was just a vector of spin configurations. Now in the limit, our basic object will be a function. So it will be this function of three coordinates when you just view it as a function of the last coordinate. Okay, so for any fixed two coordinates, let's think of this as a function of the last coordinate. That will be the configuration. So it's bounded by one, but let me really think of this as a function in the Hilbert spacer L2, which I will explain in a second why this is a good idea. So if when you start plugging in uniform random variables into the second coordinate, you can really think of this as a sequence of functions. Now, random sequence of functions, of course, sampled from a random measure, because, you know, like when you have a random variable with values in some space, you can of course imagine that there is a measure on the sample space. So the same thing here, this is a random variable with values in this space of functions. So you can simply take that sample, the measure, so you can take the uniform measure on 0, 1 and push it in the mathematical notation by this map, u goes into the function. And this is a random measure because it still depends on this common randomness on W. So you end up with this object, which I call asymptotic Gibbs measure. So in the limit, you simply have now a random measure on the space of functions instead of vectors of spins. You sample from that measure, you sample functions, and that what you need to do is just take these functions and plug in IID uniform random variables to generate your spins. Well, you have to flip a coin at the end also, but let me not repeat that step. So it's exactly the same visual picture as you had before the limit. So you can talk about the thermodynamic limit in terms of this asymptotic Gibbs measure. And the reason why this is L2 is because if you look what happens to overlaps, the overlaps in the limit will be nothing but the scalar product of these replicas in the limit in L2. Okay, you can easily check that's the case. So for this reason, remember I said in the beginning that in the SK model, everything is encoded, all the information about the model is encoded in the overlaps because of this rotational symmetry. So in the SK model, we really don't care what the Hilbert space is like, because if you take this measure and just imagine that it lives on another Hilbert space, just moved by isometry, when you sample from that random measure, all we care about is scalar products, right? The scalar products will describe everything. But in the diluted models, it's a more complicated situation, because when you sample these functions, you don't only, you know, care what their scalar product is like, but you really want to know how these functions look like, because you have to generate the spins plugging in IID uniform random variables. Okay.
So,
the W, it was, remember, it was the common randomness of this array here in the limit. So you have a limit and you have a function of these four variables, or here three variables. So W is just a uniform random variable on 0, 1. So in the limit, you can think of W as the randomness of the Gibbs measure. So before the limit, what was the randomness of the Gibbs measure? That was your disorder, right? The interaction parameters were random. In the limit, the Gibbs measure is still random. and the randomness is encoded in this W. Okay? So you have a random measure before the limit, you have a random measure. In the limit, the only difference is it's now on the space of functions instead of on finite configurations.
And we think we're just taking some continuum limit in which the spins are getting very close together.
Well, you're taking continuum limit, but simply in the end, the infinite sequence of spins is generated by a function. That's what happens. Okay.
So it's no simple relation.
Is it some kind of Legendre transformed variable, or is there a way to think of it like that?
I cannot see the connection. So in the limit, simply your configuration will be a function, and to produce individual coordinates, you will take this function, that's a function on 0, 1, and you will simply plug in IID uniform random variables to produce the spins for that particular replica or configuration.
Where will you plug them in?
You will plug them into the function, because the configuration is just...
And what argument will you?
Well, you see here, this guy is a function on simply on 0, 1. The argument is 0, 1, right?
It's a point on the unit interval.
It's a point on the unit interval.
Yeah.
So you will simply plug in independent points on the unit interval to generate the coordinates. Okay?
Just any point you like, where you have to choose them randomly?
Randomly. This will be a random independent sequence of points on 0, 1. So simply, the point here is that because of the symmetries that you have in the model, in the limit, everything is generated in a very similar way, just a little bit more complicated. Everything sits on the space of functions. Your basic configurations is now a function in L2, in this Hilbert space. So now let me start describing what the physicists predict about this model. So first, let me talk about the Parisi solution in the SK model, where we have to only describe what happens to the scalar product. So we will not even talk about individual coordinates here. So the first thing is that this random measure will be on the sphere, okay? On the sphere, on non-random sphere in this Hilbert space. So that's one thing. And the most important and the most famous prediction is this ultrametricity, okay, the ultrametric choice of overlaps in the Parisi ansatz, which basically in this language here, in this geometric point of view, it simply says that the support of this random measure, so you have a measure on the sphere where it's supported, it will be supported on some set which is ultrametric in L2. Now, what that means is the following. That if you take any three points, or if you sample any three points from your limiting asymptotic Gibbs measure, the distances between them will satisfy not just a triangle inequality on the Hilbert space, but a strong triangle inequality. You will have a maximum instead of the sum, right? So let me explain now how you can think about this. So that's just the definition of what ultrametricity means. There is a very natural way to think about this if you rephrase this property a little bit differently. So let me rephrase it like this. If you take any distance r and you define a relation between points in the support of your Gibbs measure, by the condition, so the relation will be given by this condition that they are within distance r from each other. You can see that this is an equivalence relation because of the ultrametric inequality, right? That means if two of them are within distance r, like one and two and one and three are within distance r, that automatically means that two and three are within distance r, right? So that's an equivalence relation. That means you can think of this as a clustering. Simply, if you take any radius, you can always separate the support of your Gibbs measure in the limit into clusters so that within each cluster they are all close within this distance from each other, but the clusters are separated by distance bigger than r. Okay? And then when you increase the distance, the small clusters will simply collapse into a bigger size clusters. So, but at every for every radius, for every size of the neighborhood that you look, it will always be an equivalence relation. So you will have this clustering process until everybody just forms one big cluster. Okay. So visually, you know, it's represented like this.
And the symbol of this 2-1, is it the same as this R1-2 that you have before? This sigma 2 minus sigma 3, is it the average of R2-2?
Oh, sigma 1, so this is, so in the limit, now I'm in the limit. So the sigma in the beginning was a finite vector. In the limit is a function. So in the limit, sigma is now a function on L2 on 0, 1. Okay, maybe I should go back. In the limit, we define the random measure on this space. So from now on, I'm forgetting about finite size system. I'm already in thermodynamic limit. And we just have a random measure on L2, on this Hilbert space of functions on 0, 1. Does it make sense? So, of course, you can translate.
Can I, when you say random measure, is that the same as probability measure?
No, it's.
Do you mean the measure itself?
Yes. So, it's in the limit, a Gibbs measure is a probability measure, like before the limit. Mm-hmm. But it was random before the limit. The randomness of the Gibbs measure came from random interactions.
Oh.
So here the Gibbs measure is random object because you have random interactions. So in the limit, it will be, think of it just as a measure on
but for one choice of interactions.
It will be just a probability measure. Just a probability measure. Yeah. Probability measure on the space of functions. So for this reason, we will have kind of two parts of the description, a purely geometric part, which just for a fixed randomness, what happens. And because it's random, then you have to also specify the probabilistic part, like what's going on from that point of view. So, okay, let me just talk about this picture more. So first thing I'm going to say is that this is not the most general case because in general, the distances in the limit can take a continuous set of values. But let's pretend that we discretize them. So when you have ultrametricity, when you have this clustering, you can simply record how points cluster at some discrete set of times. And in the worst, you know, you introduce a little error epsilon. So this just gives you an approximation. And so I'm going simply to pretend that all the points in the Gibbs measure in the limit just have finitely many distances that they can take. Their distances can take finite set of values. So in this case, the clustering process will just have this finite set of steps. And so in this picture, first of all, in this case, in the discrete approximation, your Gibbs measure will really live just on a countable sequence of points. So now you imagine you are on the sphere on the space of functions, and it's concentrated just on the sequence of points with some non-zero weights here. And these functions is what is called pure states, right? In these models, this is exactly what is called pure states. The pure state now is just a function in L2. Okay. And these functions are encoded or enumerated by the leaves of this tree. So you start with just the functions. And then when you go one level up, it just means you look what are your neighbors at the closest possible distance. And the vertices at the second level just tell you what the clusters of the pure states will be like. Then when you go to a bigger distance, the smaller clusters join into bigger clusters and so on. So in terms of the distances, everything is encoded by this clustering. By this clustering tree. So for example, if you take any two pure states, so these are the points in the support of your Gibbs measure here, and you want to know what is the distance between them, well, you only need to tell me what the scalar product is between them. That's another, right? As the distance increases, the scalar product decreases. So all you do, if you want to see what the scalar product between them is in L2, is to find where they clustered. Go to the lowest common ancestor and just see what that level is. The level is denoted by that wedge notation alpha beta. And you simply look, what was the value for the scalar product at that level, right? So the distances between points are encoded by this tree, basically. That's what ultrametricity means. It's the same as clustering. You should really think of it as clustering of the points when you look at different distances. The clusters just grow like this along the tree. So, and another, so you notice here that I encode the vertices by the powers of natural numbers. That simply means that that's also part of the Parisian ansatz, that every time a cluster breaks into a smaller subclusters, it breaks into infinitely many. So that's also the fact here, that each vertex in this tree has infinitely many children. So that's also part of it. So you can simply, you know, introduce the next natural number is just telling you which turn you take at the next step as you move. So let's say you move from the root of the tree to the leaf, you can encode this whole path just by natural number here, add another natural number, which just tells you which, you know, which orders the children. So in the end, it's just R natural numbers that tell you exactly which path you take from the root to the leaf, okay?
So, is this similar to some sort of p-adic numbers?
There is a connection, yes. P-adic numbers, it's you know, there is also this ultrametric picture, but of course the definition is different, but there is also the similar. No, here it's just, here you are just in some, there is a very specific example, but here you are just in the abstract, you know, situation, you know, you can define it just on the metric space. So you have some distances, and that ultrametricity here just tells you how the distances are, you know, that the distances this between points have this additional property. It's stronger than triangle inequality. But it's kind of a more general, let's say, more soft definition here. But there, yes. So that's a geometric part of the picture. I also mentioned that's a random measure. So everything here is random, like the weights of the corresponding to our pure states, the Gibbs weights, they are random. So there is also a description of weights here. And I'm not going to explain how what it is, but there is a very precise, exact description how you generate all the weights in this Gibbs measure. And this is what is called Ruelle probability cascades, because David Ruelle was, you know, the first one who formulated in a precise mathematical, you know, language what these weights will look like in the limit thermodynamically. All right. So that's the Parisian ansatz for SK model. And you see, once we have it, then we know everything about SK model. Well, at least we have all the information. If you want to describe how the sample looks like, everything is here. You have the random, you describe precisely the randomness of the weights when you sample your points from this Gibbs measure. And then you just see, look at the structure of this tree, which tells you everything about their distances, right? Now, in the diluted model, that's not enough. So when we move on, yes?
I just said that, was the physical background of this spin glass? Is that the idea that it's meant to be a model of it?
Yes, it's just the Ising model. Originally, like what is called Edwards-Anderson model, it was on the lattice. As usual, only you take interaction to be random, right? Instead of ferromagnetic or anti-ferromagnetic, they're just disordered interaction. So that was the model which was too complicated to solve exactly. And so the mean field approximation, it's kind of struck a balance that it's still very rich, but it was exactly solvable. So the mean field here is just means you remove the
thinking of something glassy then, specifically.
The glass, I think
because
the word
kind of structure, this clustering somehow is reminiscent
of glass. The glass, as far as I understand in spin glasses, the glass refers just to the fact that you have a disorder, I mean, you have a disordered bond interactions. So instead of a positional disorder like in glass, here it refers, it's just by analogy. I don't think it means anything like referring to glass, physical glass.
So what I was asking is if the structure is related to the existence of many local maximums and one global maximum.
Oh, that's, you know, yes, that's kind of an intuitive point of view, yes, that you can, okay, so when you look, you can bring it back to the original, you know, Gibbs measure, and you just have to say that something like this holds approximately. So what does it mean? You know, that means that somehow you can find clusters in the Gibbs measure that carry all your weight, but they are also, you know, separated like this in the, maybe organized in this ultrametric way. And, you know, people imagine that you have, yes, that you have many local minima. So you have some ground state, but you have many local minima. And, you know, if you look at that neighborhood, it carries some weight. So that would be something corresponding to one pure state or one cluster. But I think it's, I mean, it's just, you know, it's not a very precise picture. It's just something that kind of a way to visualize what's going on. Does it make sense? But yes, the people also prove, you know, there are results showing that there are many local minima and so on. They're also that kind of picture that you have in mind. Okay, so the diluted model. So it starts by saying that if you just care about the distances or the overlaps, everything should be the same, right? If you would look at your pure states or your functions in the support of the Gibbs measure and just look at their distances, the picture will be the same. So what is new here is now you care. Yes. Yes.
Is it true that you were describing kind of what are the important configurations in the sum over the sigma? The ones that dominate, what is their description of the continuum limit? This is what you were doing, right? Explaining what are the appropriate functions to describe in a continuum limit, the spin loss, right?
Right. So
can you now explain the next step, how to connect to the free energy? What would be the next step? What would we do with this information about the ultramagnetic?
So At the very philosophical level, if you look at, so the free energy, you're looking at the partition function, right? So the Gibbs measure just tells you what are the configurations that contribute essentially to the partition function. So if you have some very, very special answer for the structure of the Gibbs measure, in principle, it tells you that, okay, you can use this special information to try to compute the partition function and the free energy. But if you're asking technically, I can do it, you know, if you give me two more hours after this talk, we can go over it because, you know, I prepared the talk for another place, but it's here. So I can tell you the technical details, but the computation is what is called cavity method. So cavity method, you use the cavity method to, you know, give a different representation for the free energy where what is important will be just the cavity field. You know, what is the cavity field? If you take just one coordinate and you look at the part of the Hamiltonian which is connected only to this one spin, so that's what is called a cavity field for this coordinate, for this spin. And then in that different representation, you just have to describe what the distribution of the finitely many or even one cavity field is in the limit under the Gibbs measure. And you can just read it off, I mean, but I cannot say it in a few words. I mean, I would have to show you much more to explain the details. But basically, yes.
Is the first step starting with a sum over spins and then replacing sums by integrals as we usually do? It's not more sophisticated.
It's just the sophisticated part, okay, it's in the understanding the structure of the Gibbs measure and that you have this very special, you know, prediction with the very special distribution of weights given by this royal probability cascades. The computation of the free energy after that, there are some very, very smart and, you know, very important ideas there too. So I'm not saying it's like completely automatic, but there are no integrals. You simply, it's a bit different. Okay. So in the diluted model, so what I mentioned before, in the diluted model, in order to compute the free energy and understand this model, you have to understand how you generate the coordinates. The overlaps is no longer, they do not have enough information. So in particular here, you have to describe, if you take one pure state, okay, alpha, and if you start, so the pure state, remember it was a random function. So if you look at just the, this is a function and omega or W here just represents the fact that this was a random function because we had a random Gibbs measure in the limit. Now, when you plug in uniform random variables into this function, that's what is called spin magnetization inside that pure states. And now you have to describe how you generate spins inside all pure states, and what is the correlation structure between the pure states, between all, for all these things. So that's what Mizard and Parisi predict on top of the Parisi solution. So the first part is simply saying that the weights of the Gibbs measure are independent of spin magnetization. So in other words, when you sample a state from your Gibbs measure, that process is independent of how the coordinates are generated within the states. And so if you know this, then now we only have to describe what happens to spin magnetization, to this array of spin magnetizations in all the pure states. And so they give the following special prediction about the correlation structure. So let me explain what it looks like. So there is also this hierarchical, you know, you're still looking at the same tree, and along this tree there is also the hierarchical correlation structure between coordinates in different pure states. And so what happens is, if you take, let me fix one pure state. So let's take at one pure state here. Pure state is encoded just by the vector of natural numbers, which tell you which path you take in this tree from the root to that pure state, right? So that's what this is. And then in order to generate spin magnetizations in that pure state, what you can do is the following. There will be some function which is called the functional order parameter here, and this function will have r plus one coordinates. That's simply the number of vertices in the path from the root to the pure state. And as you walk along, so as you move from the root toward the pure state, at every vertex along the way, you plug in another independent random variable on 0, 1. And moreover, they are also independent over the spin coordinate index I. So in other words, if you look at different spins, they are all independent. You know, they are all independent of each other. But if you fix one spin, let's say you fix here I equals to 1, you just look at the first spin, but you want to look at it now in all the pure states at the same time, there will be a very special correlation between pure states, right? If you take two pure states, as long as they move together along the, you know, from the root, they share the same randomness, and as soon as they separate, they use independent randomness. So there is this very special hierarchical correlation structure between the pure states. Okay. So that's another part of the picture which is new, which was not in the SK model, or let's say it was not important in the SK model. We didn't need this piece of information to compute the free energy. But in the diluted models, you need this in order to compute the free energy.
This diluted model, whenever you generate a configuration, you generate a new connectivity graph, a new graph, or the graph is fixed, and then I forgot what are the rules of the game for this model.
As the size of the system grows, every time you generate a new graph, and you generate the interactions, random interactions along that graph every time, right? Okay, so that's the picture, you know, the ansatz in the physics. Let me mention some of the results. I don't remember when we started. I guess it was like 10 minutes late, right? So I have about 10 minutes. So the Parisi picture for the overlaps, now we know how to prove it in all these models. So there is a very soft approach, which in all in other models, you can prove it in the Edwards-Anderson model, if you like, on the lattice also, but there are other issues there that I will try to mention a little bit later. So the Parisi solution is true in all these models, and you prove it in exactly the same way everywhere. It's really not a part of it has nothing to do with the model. I will try to say a little bit more about it later. As for the diluted model, I can prove that the first part is correct, that the sampling process is independent of how you generate the spins. But the most general result at this moment about the spin magnetizations in the pure states is this symmetry, which I call hierarchical exchangeability, which simply says that if you take your pure states and you reorder them in any way you like by some bijection of, you know, the leaves of this tree, as long as you preserve the structure of this tree, in other words, you preserve the distances between them. So, for example, if you had four pure states that form this particular pattern in this tree, after the permutation, they should form the same pattern in this tree. So under such permutations, there is a symmetry between all the pure states. Okay, so there is this hierarchical symmetry of magnetizations inside all the pure states. And then in a joint work with Tim Austin, we proved that there is an analog of this Aldous-Huber representation for such hierarchically exchangeable arrays. And so the most general way that you can generate such arrays, it starts to look exactly like what Mizard and Parisi want, with a little bit, you know, difference that you have another set of coordinates, which also depend on the path in the tree, but it's shared by all the spins. So there is no, these do not depend on the spin index I. So the way you can think about it is, first, you generate a function in all the pure states in this hierarchical way along the path in this tree. But this will be, you know, this will be different functions everywhere, but they will be symmetric in this sense. And then you will use the function, these functions, to generate the spins exactly in the fashion that we want, right? In the, also along the tree. So what is missing is this additional symmetry here, that Mizard and Parisi, what they want is the same function sitting in all the pure states. You're using the same function to generate the spins along the tree. Actually, on the slide before, I just took this to be a non-random function, but it's totally fine if you make it, if this is a random function that just depends on, let's say, the randomness at the root. So it's shared by the whole tree. It does not affect the formula for the free energy, for example. So there is this gap is this additional symmetry that we want. And so results in this direction, that I can show that this is true in the SK model. So in the SK model, you know, I kept saying we are not really interested, but it's a valid question you can ask: how the spins are generated, what is the correlation structure for the spins? And in that case, it is true that it's generated exactly in this way. And moreover, you can say much more about what this functional order parameter is, this function T. So that's one motivation for this kind of ansatz. A more interesting recent result is I can also prove that in the simplest non-trivial case in the diluted model. So the simplest non-trivial case is one step of replica symmetry breaking, which just corresponds to the tree with one level, right? And all your pure states are just at the same distance from each other. So the leaves of the tree are right under the root of the tree. So in that case, the exchangeability would give you this kind of representation. You go from the root directly to pure state, and then you generate the spin going from the root directly to pure state. And you want to get rid of this coordinate here that generates this function. And this I can also do using additional information in the cavity equations. So there are these so-called cavity equations for the spins, and there is additional information that generates this. So finally, R was just how many, remember that tree we had? That was how many levels we had in the tree. So, because of ultrametricity, you can approximate by finitely many levels. So it's an approximation. Normally, you can have a situation where the distance take continuous set of values. So you can say infinity. But the general case can be always approximated in a very strong sense by the discrete case. and you only have to describe what discrete case looks like.
Okay. So it's like zooming in the spectrum, and you think you are in the global minimum, but that's the metastable. Is it like some fractal structure of the spectrum that you are cross-grain, you don't care about going zooming in and in?
I'm thinking of this in a much simpler way than that, but if that helps, that's also fine.
That's correct.
Well, I mentioned before that this picture that you have with many valleys and so on, that's already kind of just it's not a rigorous picture. It's very hard, like when you look at the Gibbs measure and you imagine a pure state, it's hard to say what exactly it looks like. It can be spread out. You can have an energy, not maybe exactly near the maximum, but the state is very big. So, I mean, it's hard to describe this very precisely in that way. Here, I'm just saying, if you have clustering picture, you can always discretize. That's all it says. So the general situation is approximated in a very, very strong sense, uniformly for all overlaps. It approximated by the discrete. But why do we want to look at the discrete? Maybe I should say that the Royal Probability Cascades, which describe the weights, they are defined just for this finitely many states, but very, very precisely.
In this number 0.76, you get the dependence on R that goes to 0.76 and R goes to infinity. You had some number, some Parisi formula, and so on. If you try to
okay.
plus in total that number when R is bigger.
Yes. Okay. We can say it like that also. When you look at the free energy formula, you can do the same thing there. You can do the same discretization. So finally, let me just say in the last couple of minutes that the interesting thing here is that all of this result on the previous slide, the last two results at the end, I said they use the cavity method. But all these results, including the entire Parisian ansatz for the overlaps, follows from one property of these models that they have in the limit, or that you can induce in the limit. And this property is called the Guerlander-Guerra identity. So Guerlander and Guerra proved that in the limit, the distribution of the overlaps will satisfy the following very simple property to state. Maybe I will need more time to explain like where it's coming from, but at least to state, it's very easy. So what is this property? If you sample n configurations from your asymptotic Gibbs measure, and you look at their scalar products, the overlaps. So you look at this Gram matrix of overlaps for this sample. So that's a random matrix, right? Random matrix of the overlaps. It turns out that it satisfies the following property, that conditionally on what you observed on the first n replicas, so conditionally on the n by n block, so if you fix n by n block, and you look at just one entry corresponding to the new replica, then this distribution, so okay, what is written here is the probability law of this new entry conditionally on the n by n block is given by the mixture like this, which just means the following, that with probability 1 over n, you can generate this new entry just independently of everything else with unconditional distribution of one entry. Or with probabilities 1 over n, you simply have to pick from one of the values that you see in the same row. Okay, so this guy will be generated, either you choose one of these values here with probabilities 1 over n, or if you didn't choose them, you have to generate it independently just from unconditional distribution. So that's the property. Now, of course, the point here is that, of course, you can generate the second entry in the same way, if you like. You just have to use the values in this row, except for the diagonal. But what this property, or what this Guerlander-Guerra identities don't tell us is how to generate this entire new column at the same time. They simply tell us how to generate one at a time, but it doesn't work. You cannot generate them like that one at a time. So the joint distribution will have some correlation, which is not explained by this. But it turns out that with a lot of work, you can show that actually, if you have this kind of property, then you know everything about this overlap array. And as long as you know the distribution of one entry, you automatically know the distribution of all the overlaps between replicas. Okay. So that's, and so a lot of information is contained in this kind of property.
This is because it's meaningful?
No, here actually this property, so okay, that's a good question. This property, if you have this property, you automatically have this whole Parisi picture. That's what I'm trying to say. And if you, okay, maybe answering your question, let me pretend that this is already a question time and I'm not over time. So it's the way it looks, just a very mysterious, very algebraic kind of representation. There is a very physical principle behind this. And the physical principle is that what they first observed is that if you look at the Sheridan-Kirkpatrick model for typical temperatures, okay, like for most temperatures, maybe with some exceptions, you will, and of course we believe that it's always true for any temperature, what you will see is that the Gibbs measure is concentrated on a constant level of energy. So there will be some level of energy that all the weight is carried by the configuration with a constant, with one level of energy. And if, and this is nothing but some algebraic manifestation of that. Simply what you do, you take your Hamiltonian, you know that it's basically constant when you average with respect to Gibbs measure. You test it on a test function, and then you integrate by parts because these are Gaussian, and what you get is this. So that was the original, you know, idea that they discovered. But it was pushed later much, you know, much more. And I think it's interesting because, you know, in physics, sometimes physicists say that you can learn a lot about the system by seeing how it reacts to the perturbation, right? You perturb and you see what happens. Here, actually, it was very interesting that once we learned, you know, this property in the SK model, then people realized that what you can do is you can now take the SK model or some generalization called P-spin models, and you can use them to perturb any other model. So simply, you know, if you have any Hamiltonian you are interested in, you add a small perturbation which is of this type. The small perturbation is small, so it does not affect anything you are interested in. It does not affect ground state energy or the free energy, because you on purpose added a small perturbation, but there is enough information in that perturbation that gives you this, and it gives the entire Parisi picture. So if you like, you can take the model on the lattice, like Edwards-Anderson model. You can add a small perturbation of SK type, and then that perturbation will induce this property and will induce the Parisi ansatz. So in the Edwards-Anderson model, the worst thing can happen is Parisi picture. But the difficult question there is there a phase transition or not? So here, we know that there is a phase transition because of the Parisi formula. That's, you read off that information from the Parisi formula for the free energy. In the Edwards-Anderson model, as far as I understand, the physicists don't even hope to have a formula for the free energy. So it's not clear how you can prove that the overlap has some non-trivial distribution. Like here, in principle, what is a phase transition is that you go at high temperature, you just have one pure state. So in terms of the asymptotic Gibbs measure, it just means your asymptotic Gibbs measure is concentrated on one point. There is just one pure state. But at low enough temperature, you know, you are in a spin glass phase, that means you really break into many pure states. So the distribution of the distance is non-trivial, right? But in the Edwards-Anderson model, it's not clear how to prove, and I think, you know, there are papers, numerical simulation that say one thing or the other, but mathematically, I think it's an interesting and difficult question. Yes.
So are there any other questions?
Physical, physical, what is the cavity, what is this cavity method that is physically, what's the idea?
Well, the idea is, okay, the idea is that, okay, there are different versions of it. So for the free energy, it also, there's this cavity equation for the for the spins. Like when you compute the Gibbs average of the spins, you can also do something like this. But basically, you know, you are when you compare a system which is has additional spin, or another way you can think of it, if you have a system and you remove one spin, you see what happens, how they okay, you could say it that way. You see what is the difference between them, and basically, for the computation of the free energy, the cavity method, it just means that, you know, you represent, you have 1 over n log of the partition function. Well, you can write log of the partition function as log of the partition function for system with n plus 1 minus log of the partition with system with n. And if you can compute that quantity, of course, the original free energy is just the average of these increments. So you get automatically that. And so here you're comparing partition function with system of one size and one additional coordinate, which would be called cavity coordinate. And then you do some computation like that.
If not, let's make this be clear.